So in Luke chapter 16, there are a couple of interesting things that at first glance are a little bit confusing, but we'll take a look at those. Thank you, Jason, for taking over for me for those few weeks. I was able to hear the last lesson last week, and Jason will be continuing after we finish Luke in 1st and 2nd Timothy, which will be whenever I finish Luke. Anyway, Luke 16, verse 1, and he, Jesus, also said to his disciples, there was a certain rich man who had a steward, and an accusation was brought to him that this man was wasting his goods. So he called him and said to him, what is this I hear about you? Give an account of your stewardship, for you can no longer be steward. So a steward is an overseer or a treasurer, a manager of a household. In this case, it would have been the manager of the household of his master. And he's fired for his dishonesty. So what he was doing was wasting his goods. It's a type of embezzlement. It's taking what is the master's and wasting it. And so the master tells him, hand in the accounts. So that's like all the accounts that you've been taking care of, we got to hand off to somebody else. So hand in your accounts because you can't be steward. Verse 3, then the steward said within himself, what shall I do? For my master is taking the stewardship away from me. I cannot dig. I'm ashamed to beg. So here he's been enjoying a life of an expensive life, apparently. He's had pleasures and relaxation, and it's at the expense of his master. And he's thinking, okay, I'm going to lose this all, and I'm not good at farming. I don't want to dig. I'm not strong that way. And I don't want to beg, so what am I going to do? So I'm going to read now verse 4 through 7, and this is what he did. I have resolved what to do, that when I'm put out of the stewardship, they may receive me into their houses. So he called every one of his master's debtors to him and said to the first, how much do you owe my master? And he said, 100 measures of oil. So he said to them, take your bill, sit down quickly, and write 50. Then he said to another, how much do you owe? So he said, 100 measures of wheat. And he said to him, take your bill, write 80. And so what he's doing is he's taking the people that are the master's debtors, but he's in charge of them, and he's discounting their bill. And he's reduced these two bills, and when you look at what oil and wheat was worth and the amounts he's talking about, it would amount to about 500 denarius, which is about 20 months of wages. So it's over a year and a half of wages that he's preparing. And what is the reason? Well, he says it in verse 4, that they, the debtors, may receive me into their houses. So I'm going to lose what I have. And he's preparing himself to do that. But of course, he's cheating the master again. Now, when you go down to verse 8, it says, so the master commended the unjust steward because he had dealt shrewdly. Now, this is a master that, I mean, he saw what the steward did, and he said he's acted shrewdly. Now, he was being cheated, and he knew he was being cheated, but he appreciated the shrewdness with which this steward had acted. And that word shrewd, when you look it up, it has a number of meanings: thoughtful, practical skill, intelligence, wisdom, prudence. So a lot of good words that describe shrewdness, but the word shrewd carries a little bit with it that idea of a little bit underhanded. So we have to look at this, and so he says, so the master commended the unjust steward because he had dealt shrewdly. For the sons of this world are more shrewd in their generation than the sons of light. So here he compares this with the sons of light, God's children, and what this man was doing. And verse 9, he says, and I say to you, make friends for yourself by unrighteous mammon, that when you fail, they may receive you into everlasting habitations. So he makes a comparison to us, and he says, you know, the unrighteous steward up in verse 4, he was concerned that they receive me into their houses. For us, we use unrighteous mammon. We'll take a look at that word, those two words in just a minute. That when we fail, whenever our lives end, or our money runs out, or whatever fails, they may receive you into everlasting habitations. So not the homes of verse 4, but an everlasting. And so I think what we have to see here is that word unrighteous mammon is really dealing, is a way of saying worldly goods and money. It's not that those things are in and of themselves unrighteous, but he's making a comparison. Here's an unrighteous steward who used things unrighteously in an unjust way, but he did it wisely. He used his brain. And a person of the world has a lot more in his toolbox than we do. He has lies, cheating, all these things that we don't have in our toolbox. And he's applying it to the children of light and saying, what you do with your worldly goods is you use that wisely, but you do it in a godly way. I think so often money and worldly goods are associated with greed and selfishness, that I think that's the use of that word there, that he's just comparing the worldly goods that we have. So what he's saying, I think in a nutshell, is there is more wisdom and shrewdness used among the worldly to succeed in material ways than God's children use worldly goods for eternal matters. So think and use your wisdom. Verse 10, he who is faithful in what is least is faithful also in much, and he who is unjust in what is least is unjust also in much. So he makes a comment about being faithful with the things that we have, and I think that's just something that is a truth that we can see, that in little things, if you're faithful, you're also faithful in big things. I think of things like being on time. If you are in the habit of being on time or being early, and you just make that a habit for your life, people will remember that, and you'll be looked at as a faithful person. Returning things when someone gives you something. I had borrowed something recently, and I kind of forgot about returning it. And what is that saying when I don't remember, it's not important enough for me to remember it. I'm telling that person something about my disposition as being a steward. I've been given a stewardship, and now I need to return it. So it's something that's important. I'm working on it myself to be better that way, to have a good disposition as a steward with money, especially if you borrow money and return that, and just follow through on what you say. In Matthew chapter 25, in verse 34, it says there, come you blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. This is that eternal habitation, that if we use our worldly goods correctly, we can look forward to that. Well, how does that happen? Because he says there that they, in verse 9, when you fail, they, those friends you make, may receive you into the everlasting habitation. Well, when we look down in what he says, for I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, you gave me drink. I was a stranger, you took me in. I was naked, you clothed me. I was a sick, you visited me. I was in prison, you came to me. And the righteous will answer, Lord, when did we see you hungry and do all these things? And verse 40, inasmuch as you did it to one of the least of these, my brethren, you did it unto me. So when we treat others that way, we are preparing an eternal habitation for ourselves. Verse 11, therefore, if you have not been faithful in the unrighteous mammon, he's using that word again, that unrighteous mammon, who will commit to you, to your trust, the true riches? The way that I handle worldly goods will really determine whether eternal things will be given to me to handle. So God is aware of how we deal and handle worldly goods, and it has something to do with what we're entrusted with, the stewardship that we're entrusted with. Verse 12, and if you have not been faithful in what is another man's, who will give you what is your own? So what is another man's? It's everything on earth, isn't it? That's something we find. We read the Bible. It all belongs to God. We are given a stewardship with whatever we own here on earth. Do we really own it? No, it's God's. And we have this stewardship, and it's another man's. It's God's. And if we have not been faithful in that, then who will give you what is your own? And of course, when I read that, I think of being in God's family. God says that when we're in God's family, when we're his sons, then we can look forward to an inheritance. That inheritance is ours. That's not something that we're merely given a stewardship over like here on earth, but it's ours. Verse 13. No servant can serve two masters, for either he'll hate the one and love the other, or else he'll be loyal to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. So there's a choice to be made. He's still on the same subject. How will I handle the worldly goods that I've been entrusted with? Will it have to do with me and myself and my greed or my plans? Or will I use it to help others, to increase God's kingdom, and look at the blessings that God gave me are yours too. I know several people that are like that. They just look at their homes and everything they have as it's all of yours. It's all of God's children, and they share things like that. And that's a great attitude to have. And if we have that proper view, we're going to have that proper view towards worldly goods. Verse 14. Now the Pharisees, who were lovers of money, also heard all these things, and they derided him. Now, as we've gone through Luke, we've seen the kind of an escalation of the Pharisees getting harder and harder and rougher with Jesus. We saw in chapter 11 and verse 53. In fact, let me just read those two verses, 11 and verse 53 and 54. Jesus was speaking, and as he said these things to them, the scribes and the Pharisees began to assail him vehemently and cross-examine him about many things, lying in wait for him, seeking to catch him in something he might say, that they might accuse him. So it has escalated to that. In chapter 15 and verse 2, they were grumbling about him, but now it says they derided him. So that means to ridicule him and to sneer at him. That's what that word means, to sneer at or ridicule. So the attitude has just slowly risen and escalated over time. The Pharisees are called lovers of money, and immediately that brings to what 1 Timothy 6:10 tells us, that the root of all kinds of, the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. And of course we see that rising to the surface with the Pharisees. Verse 15, and he said to them, "You are those who justify yourselves before men, but God knows your hearts, for what is highly esteemed among men is an abomination in the sight of God." So you desire what's highly esteemed among men. You desire to be honored, to be lofty. That's that word, highly esteemed, is to be lofty. And that's what you desire. And God looks at that as a detestable thing. That word detestable is that same word that God uses in his word to describe idols. They are a detestable thing. And so it's what Jesus is revealing, and of course the Pharisees would know how that word is used as in reference to idols, and he's using it on the Pharisees. Verse 16, the law and the prophets were until John. Since that time, the kingdom of God has been preached, and everyone is pressing into it. So we look at the law and the prophets. So we look at Moses bringing the law, and then all the way to Malachi, the last prophet before John. So we've got that whole period of time, and then you've got 400 years of silence before John begins speaking. And what is John saying? John has been saying, as we look through in Luke, the kingdom of God is at hand. It's just around the corner. And Jesus himself said, the kingdom of God is very soon. since that time, since John, the kingdom of God has been preached, and everyone is pressing into it. So what does that mean, that idea that people are trying to force the kingdom of God? We know that it began in 33 AD on the day of Pentecost. We can read about it in Acts chapter 2. But somehow there was some pressure to push the kingdom quicker. And there's a few scriptures we can look at in John 6 and verse 15. Therefore, when Jesus perceived that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, he departed again to the mountain by himself alone. So there were some that saw Jesus, and they were going to by force make him king, you know, bring this kingdom early. In Luke chapter 19 and verse 11, now when they heard these things, he spoke another parable, because he was near Jerusalem, and because they thought the kingdom of God would appear immediately. So they were expecting it immediately. In verse 36 of that same chapter, this is where they were spreading their clothes on the road. So they, as Jesus came into town, they were preparing for the king to arrive. And then even in Acts chapter 1 and verse 6, we remember that the disciples themselves said, is it at this time that the kingdom is being restored? So there was that pressure for the kingdom to come, and they knew it was near, but there was pressure there. Verse 17, and it is easier for heaven and earth to pass away than for one tittle of the law to fail. So he reminds them, you're wanting to press this new kingdom, but we're under the law. Don't leave this. There is not one tittle, which is a part of a letter on the, let's see, is that the Greek or Hebrew? I'm not sure what tittle refers to, but it's talking about a part of a letter in either the Greek or the Hebrew alphabet that would change a word from the tense of a word or change a word slightly. And Jesus is saying, not one of those little, it's called a horn, one of those little horns will change in the old law, in Moses' law. And so he reminds them, as this pressure is going to bring in the new kingdom, he says, it's easier for heaven and earth to pass away than for one tittle of the law to fail. And then in verse 18, he brings up this subject, which seems like, what's this doing in the middle of this chapter? Whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery. And whoever marries her who is divorced from her husband commits adultery. So this was, as we look back historically, we see that this is one area that the Pharisees were really lax on. And they had made their own rules about marriage and divorce. And he reminds them, it's like right at the Pharisees, what you're doing, you are changing God's law. And so he brings an obvious one to them up and says, remember what the law says? Now in verse 19, we change now. We've kind of finished that, and we're going into that story of the rich man and Lazarus. And they are connected. The two halves of this chapter are connected. But let's just jump into this, because this is just a tremendous passage of both comfort but also fear, because it makes us look at what happens when we die. And we're talking about the person who's bringing this to us is the Alpha and the Omega. He is the Eternal One, and he has the keys to death and Hades. This is the person we want to listen to. He's telling us something about what happens when we die. He's our Redeemer, and he has the key to death and Hades. So let's listen to what he says. There was a certain rich man who was clothed in purple and fine linen and fared sumptuously every day. So that purple was a rare, expensive dye. They got it from a shellfish in the Mediterranean Sea, and one out of each shellfish they would get one drop of this dye, of this purple dye. And so it was a very expensive dye that was used for really mostly royalty. And then the fine linen too, it was this bright white, and the cost of that linen, you take a linen shirt or whatever and you weigh it, it costs twice its weight in gold. That's how expensive a fabric it was. So, and then sumptuously is just living luxuriously. He had servants, he was banquets, that was his life. Verse 20, but there was a certain beggar named Lazarus, full of sores, who was laid at his gate, desiring to be fed with the crumbs which fell from the rich man's table. Moreover, the dogs came and licked his sores. So here is, the word beggar means to crouch or cringe, to be distressed. So here is this beggar that is right at the front door, at the gate of this rich man. And you got this contrast, this luxurious living, and this man that the dogs are licking his sores, and he wants the crumbs that are left over. So really, we go back to the first half of this chapter, and we saw that first half was about the unjust steward and how shrewd he was. And the thing that we want to learn from it is, how do we use our worldly goods? Well, here's a man who had a lot of worldly goods, and he wasn't doing it right. And so we're finding kind of in the rich man Lazarus, what are the consequences of not using your property, your goods, correctly to serve God? Verse 22, so it was that the beggar died and was carried by the angels to Abraham's bosom. The rich man also died and was buried. So the angels carry away the beggar. And when we look at what David said in Psalms chapter 90 and verse 10, he says, after we die, we fly away. And so when the angels carry you, they're flying. That's, we learn a little bit more about it. I think, you know, it's in just a few days, it's going to be a year since Lowell died. And he had, I remember sitting in that room with him in the hospital, and you'd be waiting till he wakes up. And as soon as he woke up, before he said hi, he'd go, open that curtain, you know, and then he'd say hi. And he was waiting for the angels. And, you know, we tried to explain, the curtains won't stop him, Lowell, you know. But he just wanted that open, that idea that the angels were coming. He wanted that open, you know, glass to look out there and see him when they arrived. The rich man also died and was buried, probably a elaborate affair, a big funeral of some sort. But verse 23 says, and being in torments in Hades, so that torments is just means what it sounds like, it's tortured. Being tortured in Hades, and Hades is the Greek word for the Hebrew word Sheol, and they both mean the same thing. They're the unseen, the grave, the place of departed souls. So it's the place that we go after we die, but before we're resurrected. So that's where we go. And being in torments in Hades, he lifted up his eyes and saw of Abraham afar off and Lazarus in his bosom. So he sees Abraham, the father of the faithful, with a faithful one, Lazarus, in his bosom with him. So it tells us a little bit more when that the condemned, when they die, they will see the saved. They will see them. And also it tells us that when we die, we know immediately how, you know, our status in heaven. You know, we know our status. So I can say immediately, because remember Jesus said on the cross to the thief, today I'll be with you in paradise. So we know it's a quick, when you die, it's quick we're in this state. Verse 24, then he, that's the rich man, cried and said, Father Abraham. So here now we know that he's an Israelite. He's a Jew. And he calls Abraham his father. Have mercy on me. In fact, in verse 25, Abraham is going to say back to him, son. So he calls him his son also. But in verse 24, have mercy on me. That is, show me compassion, show me pity. And when we think about God's mercy, we've already been through Luke when we looked in chapter 6 on the Sermon on the Mount, when Jesus taught, judge not that you be not judged, condemn not that you be not condemned, and be forgiving if you expect forgiveness. Well, all those things are mercy. And so if we want to expect mercy from God, we have to be merciful. And so here he is, he's asking for mercy, but he hasn't been merciful. Send Lazarus that he may dip the tip of his finger in water and cool my tongue, for I'm tormented in this flame. So it's just a drop of water would give me comfort. But Abraham said, son, remember that in your lifetime you received your good things, and likewise Lazarus evil things, but now he is comforted and you are tormented. That word comfort is that same word for you are exhorted, which means to call near to, to call up next to. And that's what he is. He's next to Abraham, isn't he? He's in his bosom. Verse 26, and besides all this, between us and you, there is a great gulf fixed. That is, the word gulf is a chasm, or other words that are used are gape or yawn. You know, a big yawn, an open mouth between you and me. And so that those who want to pass from here to you cannot, nor can those from there pass to us. So there is a chasm you can't cross. There is no more choice on crossing this chasm. The gulf is so wide, and this should bring to mind, too, the gulf is crossable now in life. But when we die, that moment, that gulf is no longer crossable. And we have to ask ourselves, I mean, how easy would it have been for the rich man to cross that gulf when he was in life? Help Lazarus. He had that opportunity all his life. He had it in front of his face. Every time he left his place at the gate, he'd see them, but he avoided them. He didn't do anything about it. And I think we have to look and ask ourselves, what is there a gulf that we won't cross in this life? Is there a sin in your life that you know about, I know about, and God knows about, but no one else does? Then cross that gulf, because it's uncrossable after you die. Right now, it's easy to cross. It may look like it's a hard one to cross. Maybe it's an addiction. Unresolved things between brethren. Are you having a problem with another brethren, somebody here, and you won't deal with it? It's just, is there a turmoil there that looks like a big gulf to cross? It isn't. It's an easy gulf compared to the gulf that we're going to face when we die. It's just interesting that you look at 1 Corinthians 6, and it tells us there that when brethren were about to sue each other, Paul had a suggestion. He told us, this is how you handle it. Take the wrong. Be defrauded. Just go ahead and take it. It's not worth it. This gulf that is separating two brethren is not worth it. You're going to face a gulf when you die, and that's going to seem like nothing. So take the wrong. Just accept the wrong yourself. So we're not suing each other, but if there is a division there, cross the gulf and take the wrong yourself. In this chapter, of course, we've been talking about, you know, serving God with our worldly goods. And so we want to ask ourselves that question, how am I doing that? Because that may be a gulf. I've made this money and I don't want to let it go, but I'm going to go ahead hold on to what I have, because I don't want to let that go. Cross that gulf. Yes?
Well, when we died, we left our physical body, and this seems to imply having fingers and tongues and physical effects, that there's a body there.
No, I think when we die, well, what death is the body and the soul are separated, and the spirit goes to God, and the body is left here. Now, there will be a resurrection of some sort, so there will be something there. But yeah, I think a lot of times we were talking in God speaks to us with what we understand. So he's using words that will help us understand. But I think every one of us thinks about, well, little baby Melody, who died, a few weeks ago. And we think about her in heaven, in paradise. She's in paradise now. And how is that without a body? Well, the only way we can think of things is with a body. So that's the way I would understand that, that God uses those things to help us understand it. I mean, that's that thing, is I don't know I know what that means as far as what a dire situation it is that you would ask for a drop of water, you know, in the torment of that flame. Could be that. Could be. Yes. Yes, that's right. And that would be 1 Corinthians 15, where that's, and but this is the place in Hades that we're talking about, is between death and the resurrection. At the resurrection, we'll receive that new body that will be exactly what we need. So all these are true. I've got to stop here. I've got a little bit left of this chapter, but I think I'll just maybe hit on that a little bit when I start next week and see if I can give a better answer, okay? Thank you.